is Writers' Voices on KRUU-FM 100.1. I am Cheryl Fusco Johnson, standing in for Monica Hadley, who is not with us today. But who is with us today is Jenny Reeves, a figurative and landscape painter and children's book illustrator who lives in Cedar Rapids. And I've known Jenny for many years, and besides being a very accomplished children's illustrator and painter, children's book illustrator, she's also a really cool person, so I'm thrilled to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Cheryl. You're also a very cool person.
So I want to share a little bit about your background with our listeners. Jenny was born in upstate New York, and she spent a number of years working abroad. She studied art and sculpture in Italy, and from an early age started painting figuratively for exhibition. She's also worked in the fields of photography, filmmaking, television, and graphic design, both in the United States and in England. A move to Kenya inspired her to paint landscapes, and that culminated in an exhibit. She's had many exhibits. That particular one was at the British Council in Nairobi. Some other exhibits of her artwork have been the Plains in Africa at the Jadeite Galleries in Midtown New York, Statements and Stories, Project Art at the University of Iowa, and Facing the Cradle, the African American Museum and Cultural Center of Iowa, which was, I think, fairly recent. And currently, there's also an exhibit going on right now through August 31st called Painted Pages. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about where that exhibit is and what it consists of.
It's at the new Phelps Youth Pavilion, which is attached to the Waterloo Center for the Arts in Waterloo, Iowa. And I think it was built around or completed around 3 years ago. And it's an adjunct to their other collections. Evidently, they have the largest Haitian collection of art in the world. But this is a hands-on children's museum, this pavilion. And it's just stunning to me. It has, it's a wonderful place to explore world cultures, Iowa cultures, American cultures. And all of these are coordinated with art disciplines like architecture and two-dimensional art, 3D art, theater, dance, music, to help a child really develop his sense of being part of the culture through art. And it's just terrific.
It actually is exactly what Jenny's saying. It's such an amazing exhibit. I was able to go visit the exhibit with Jenny. Visit the, yes, Phelps Pavilion. There's a permanent exhibit of adult art, and also the thing that's 3 years old is the Phelps Pavilion, Youth Pavilion, and that has 81 interactive exhibits for children.
Right.
And currently there is an exhibit that's ending at the end of August, and that includes some of Jenny's work. And in fact, I talked to some of the staff at the Phelps Youth Pavilion, and this particular exhibit was inspired because Kent, one of the people who works there.
Ken Schenkel is the curator for the Phelps Youth Pavilion.
Okay, so the curator saw the African American Museum exhibit, I believe.
Yes.
Saw, and was inspired to have some sort of an exhibit of Jenny's work at his museum. And then they rounded up three other children's illustrators. And maybe you could remind me who they are?
Gary Kelly, who's very well known nationally as a children's book illustrator and a painter, an artist, and a muralist. For instance, he did the Barnes & Noble Cafe Writer's Mural that appears in most of the Barnes & Noble cafes. And he's been around for quite a while up there and does a lot of work for the city of Cedar Falls. Then there is Bonnie Kolak, who has featured in this exhibition her linoleum cuts, and she accompanies her work with music because she actually is a performer and has been around since the mid-60s. And then there's Shaviva Banks Ferguson, who does children's illustration, and sometimes she writes these contemporary books about cultural diversity, specifically African-American contemporary situations.
So it's an incredible exhibit. There's so much to see. So anyone who felt like taking a little trip to Waterloo, your time would be well rewarded. But let's talk a little bit about some of your books. And you do have two books out this year, but before we get to your new books that came out in 2011, I'd like to talk about one of the first books you did. Mm-hmm. And you can also tell us a little about how that book is featured in this exhibit you have in Waterloo. But the book I'm talking about is Colors of Kenya. It came out in 1998 mm-hmm. through Carol Rhoda Books. And I'd like you to just tell us a little about how that book came to be.
I have always been interested in storytelling and illustration, and I started adapting fairy tales in London, and continued to do so in New York, but at that point I was unpublished. When we moved here for my husband's work, I had known about Lerner Publications and made an appointment to see the art director up there, taking my portfolio, which included a lot of my work on Kenya, because I had done three major exhibitions of Kenya by that time, and some of my other work was also in the portfolio. And serendipitously, or by chance, they were also doing a book in their Colors of the World series called The Colors of Kenya. And I was...
That is really serendipitous, isn't it?
Yes.
What great timing. So you were living in Iowa, and you just cold called them up.
Yes.
Right? And said, I'd like to come up to Minneapolis.
Right.
And show you my art.
Yes. They suit me because they're nonfiction, they're history, biography, and I love to explore in the past and explore people and nature, which is indirectly involved in history. So at any rate, we had a tour of the publishing house and the art department, and at the end of it, he offered me this book to illustrate, The Colors of Kenya.
It was a perfect timing for you. Mm-hmm. And so what was your research like? Did you just go through your own... I think I've read something about you having photo safaris when you're in Kenya.
Yes, well, we lived in Kenya for 3 years, and and I really love living in places for a longer period of time than actually traveling there and staying in a hotel for a couple of weeks and then moving on. So I felt very much a part of Kenya and a part of the landscape and the people, and I started collecting children's stories, folk tales, Kenyan folk tales.
While you were in Kenya.
While I was there, and I photographed Kenya, I sketched it, I kept a journal every day, and I started painting almost immediately I got there, the landscape. And landscape was something up until that point that I was uninterested in, that excited and it inspired me.
So the change in scenery, because you've had already traveled quite a few places before you got there.
Right.
But this particular landscape really resonated with you?
It did. It was diverse. It was on the equator and yet had mountains and deserts and coastlines and the Great Rift Valley, which is a stunningly primitive place to go. And it was well suited for the culture. I mean, the people were all around. They walked the paths of this beautiful country, and they themselves were very diverse. There were 42 different tribes, all unique in their ways. And so I was just really inspired by what I saw once there. So I had all this material for my first book, but I also had a solo exhibition at the British Council that I prepared for while we were living there. I had a solo exhibition in New York on Kenya, and I had a two-man show in Rochester with a Ghanaian potter on Africa. And I had another show, which was a three-man show on Africa, too. So, and then we moved here, and I had the Facing the Cradle exhibition, although that was after the book. But
so
but
to me, it
Africa
like
has followed me outside.
Yeah, well,
the continent.
I think that's partly because of your love of that place. Mm. But to me, it sounds like the problem with your research was not finding material. It would be trying to hone things down because you had a finite like number of pages to work with.
I didn't author this book. Fran Sammis did, and she did a wonderful job of actually describing Kenya. So I had to work with what she had.
So she's chosen
the colors.
But you still had this plethora of material. So you would have to decide if you're... So the book is set up like each page is, or two-page spread is a color. Is that right?
Yes, not completely two-page. There's it crosses the center line, which in publishing is called the gutter. And it falls on both sides, but it's not completely... a double-page spread, which is what I work in nowadays.
But so you were dealing with, was it 10 colors?
10 colors. It was a 24-page book, and it had a map in the front of the book, which I didn't do. But each color was spot on. Like, for instance, red represented the sunsets, which are very striking and dramatic and come at 6 p.m. every night because it's on the equator. It's 6 hours, 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of night, basically. And so so that I remembered. I also remembered that the Maasai in Kenya, not necessarily in Tanzania because they're there as well, but they use red in their rituals, perhaps because there's a lot of red ochre about, but it does represent to them bravery. So she had, Fran had put these two together, and I used them and expanded on them.
So with this was your first experience tailoring your art to someone else's text. How
actually
was that for you?
It wasn't my first book. As it turned out, my first book was a biography on Booker T. Washington, and so I had learned the ropes basically with Booker T. Washington. I had a very good graphic designer, Julie Sisler, who provided me with templates because everything has to be structured around the text. And I also had a very good editor who walked me through it. We had wonderful talks about history and culture.
So both those books, the Booker T. Washington and The Colors of Kenya, were with Carol Rhoda.
Right.
You were offered that Kenya book first, but it was delayed for a while, so you ended up doing the other book. And
correct.
How did you feel about that? Did you feel like you just had really good support from your publisher in learning the ropes of how to illustrate
yes.
books?
Yes. Even though they might say, you know, we want you to do a book, you still have to do a preliminary sketch before they will hire you because they want to see whether you can keep within the parameters of the page. And they want to see how expressive you can be. So I was asked to represent a full-page illustration out of Booker T. Washington's story. And so I chose what I wanted to do and worked it up. And on the merits of what they saw there, they hired me to do that first book. And I'm not sure whether other illustrators have that, but I wouldn't be surprised.
The support from the publisher, you mean?
Well, they want to know whether you can work within the bounds of the book and also whether you can work to deadline. And so I had a certain amount of time I had to do it.
And now, of course, your publishers know this because you have 15 books out, so they know you have a track
right.
record.
Right.
So you mentioned your actual first book, and the art in that one was probably a lot different than the Kenya art.
Mm-hmm.
So first, I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield Radio and beyond. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. I'm standing in for Monica Hadley. And with me today is Jenny Reeves, a figurative and landscape painter and children's book illustrator from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So right now what we're talking about is how does an illustrator choose a certain style of art for different sorts of text?
Everyone is different. Every artist approaches this differently. For me, I like the variety because these are about history, and I can use the technique and the medium to sort of remind the reader or the viewer that that it is a particular period in time. So I use it in some ways like a set design. For instance, for one of my books, Frederick Douglass, which the illustrations are for an older reader, and they're in black and white, I could choose whatever medium to use in that color. But I chose pen and ink because it reminded me of the engravings from newspapers and magazines like Scribner's and Harper's of the time, and he was a public figure, and so I felt that this in some way indirectly would help the story set it where it should be in the mid-1850s.
And so that book was Voice of Freedom, a story about Frederick Douglass, and that came out in 2001 also from Carol Rhoda.
Carol Rhoda, and the author is Marianne N. White.
So I've had the opportunity to read a number of your books and have looked over the titles, and they all seem to really have an altruistic bent. You know, they're biographies, they're myths, and I admire that thread that runs through. Was that really important to you when you were choosing which publisher you were going to cold call? Did you look at their catalog and see what they'd published and decided, oh yeah, that company's a good fit for me?
I knew about Lerner in New York, and they had a reputation. Actually, they are one of the largest. I think there are three nonfiction publishers, one of the largest in the States, and they produce a lot of photographic illustrated books. They produce a lot of illustrated books from illustrators as well. And they had a reputation of starting the illustrator onto other things. So it seemed a good fit for me, and one of the few big publishers that would give me the chance to actually illustrate.
So when you say they had a reputation of starting the illustrator on other things, what do you mean?
Oh, sorry, that didn't come out very well, did it? What I meant was that emerging artists and emerging illustrators have to start somewhere, and usually is with publishers that are not the big trade book publishers like Harper's, for instance, in New York. So they give the boost to emerging illustrators, and then they can move on and get agents and things like that.
Have you used other publishers as well?
No, I have stuck.
So you've been
mainly
pretty happy where you are.
I do like the stories they produce.
I wanted to ask you, after you did your Colors of Kenya book, then you did Colors of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Kenya was someplace you had been.
Right.
Colors of Russia, which came out in 2002 from Carol Rhoda by Shannon, is it
Zemlika.
Zemlika. You hadn't been there.
I hadn't visited Russia.
So how was the research different?
Well, I had to look up a number of things in books and magazines, and it was completely different. I didn't have time to even if I had the money to travel there and absorb it. So, and this is the case with some of my books. I don't have the time, so I have to use other sources. For that was rather difficult because I couldn't use the historic sources that would be available to me here in the States. I used National Graphics, you know, that went way back to 1918. And
I think I've seen your collection of National Geographic.
Right. So, you know, I get inspiration. I don't use, I sketch things out. I take bits from one and bits from another, and then I reorganize and paint, you know, that way. But I prefer to always visit wherever the story is based in, if I can.
Can you tell us some of your travels where you've done that?
Well, for Booker T. Washington, I traveled to Virginia, to the farm that he was born a slave at, and that was very interesting. And then I traveled to San Antonio to visit the Alamo for one of my later books.
When you go to these places, what sorts of things do you do? So when you went to the Alamo, what were you doing?
For the Alamo, I had the story before I went.
So you had the text that the author had written.
Yes, not the final draft, but I had one that I could work with and knew what I needed to see in order to construct the Alamo as it appeared at that time, because it's completely different now. So I went there. I had also made an arrangement to meet with the curator, Dr. Bruce Winders, and I went at an annual program. They have an annual program where they celebrate the pre-dawn attack that devastated the Alamo. And so they reenact from all over the world. People come to this and reenact.
This takes a lot of pre-planning, doesn't it? Because that's an annual event.
Right.
You have to decide in advance of your deadline to go there.
Right.
So how much
Well,
time
I just make a phone call. That's what it always starts with, is a phone call. And they told me about this, and I said, oh, well, it's in 2 weeks, and I better hustle. And so I got there, and it was wonderful. I was there a week, I photographed everything. I sketched if there was something that needed to be reassembled. I walked around the entire town taking pictures of artifacts from that period that I could use, and just having a great time on the river walk drinking margaritas with my husband. It was wonderful.
It's nice he was free at that short notice
well,
to go with you.
Yeah, he joined me on the weekend. He wasn't there all the time. And they had reenactors who always provide, you know, such explicit detail, especially with things like guns and horses and things like that, that are really good for these particular history books, because a lot of people follow the Alamo, and they can be quite critical if you're out of if you're out of period in any way.
Yeah, making some mistakes. I imagine that, like, historical reenactors are always thrilled to have someone take an interest in what it
yes.
is that they're doing.
Well, that's exactly what they do. And I don't know whether you follow them. I did another book on Willie McLean and the Civil War surrender, which took place in Appomattox. And I didn't go to Appomattox for that, but in Cedar Rapids, there was a reenactment in the summer on a Civil War, in a particular Civil War battlefield. And so I walked around taking pictures of that, and I used that.
Your job actually sounds sort of fun.
It is. Everyone should do this.
It seems like, you know, it takes you out of yourself. Being an artist, you probably have a lot of inward time that you spend in your very beautiful home studio that I got to visit last weekend.
Yeah. It's playing in a way, but it's also constructive. It's exploring. You know, it's finding out things that you didn't know. You know, you learn so much. And so I guess in some ways it's like being forever young, because
always learning.
All those aha moments.
know? Sounds great. Again, I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield Radio and beyond. This is Cheryl Fusco-Johnson standing in for Monica Hadley at Writer's Voices. KRUU-FM is stream. You can listen to it online at kruufm.com. And this station is the first and only solar-powered station in the Midwest. And joining me today is Jenny Reeves, a figurative and landscape painter and children's book illustrator. She has 15 children's books that she's illustrated, and we're thrilled that she lives right here in Iowa in Cedar Rapids. And we've just been talking about some of the challenges, although it doesn't sound like you consider your career to be challenging, because it sounds like you have a lot of fun at it. But one of the things I noticed, we haven't mentioned the titles of your two very recent books. So one of them we have been talking about, and that was Enrique Esparza.
Enrique Esparza.
And the Battle of the Alamo. That came out.
Susan Taylor Brown.
And it came out this year, 2011, and it's part of a History Speaks series. And that's one of the things I admire about Jenny's work, is she does just these wonderful books that help people become well-informed and get good information. And this particular series seems to be like a reader's theater. Did you want to explain a little about what it is?
Yes. Well, this was the publisher's idea, was to come out with this reader's theater where you have a 32-page story, and illustrated story, and then at the end of it, it's scripted so that the viewers and readers can then perform it and become the characters that they see in the story.
Yeah, it looks like a nice, easy activity to do in a classroom
it
that
is.
Would sort of enliven things. And when I visited Jenny's studio recently, she showed me some of her notebooks, and I happened to see some of the drawings that led to the final work that appears in this particular book about the Alamo, and Jenny's husband Stuart was featured in a lot of these drawings. So maybe you could tell us a little about your process and your use of models.
Well, the process starts with reading the manuscript and saying yay or nay to whether it strikes me as something I can illustrate. Then comes the research, which is early on, first 3 months. I break things down into months. I usually have 6 months, and the research overlaps everything.
In 6 months, you're doing this research where you're doing these travels, and then you're coming up with, like, how many pieces of art, how many paintings do you make for one book?
Well, you have to break things down into components so that you can handle in the end the finished artwork. So the first thing I do is I research and I start sketching in a very abstract way how I want each picture in the book to flow from one to the other, because the idea of a picture book is that you want to turn the page, both with the story, the text, and the illustration has to force you to do that. And you have to sort of think of that abstractly first. And when I'm reading the manuscript, the thing that will really make me want to do the book is if I identify with the character, especially the main character, but the situation that he or she finds herself in. And I see expressions, you know, how they might react or act.
So the emotional quality of...
is very important. But then, after I've then decided to take on the book, the research will open up other things.
Before you go on to that, I have one question. Have you ever read the text and not resonated with the main character and said, you know, I think I'm going to pass on this one?
Yeah.
What's the difference between one that you take and one that you reject?
Well, I draw animals well, and I like and love animals, but when they're the central character of a book, I don't feel in the same way. And so
like if you're doing a folkloric, because you have done,
well,
some
folklore
folk
is
tales.
Different. I'm talking about history basically. So I was
would
offered
there be a history book that would just be animals?
Well,
I mean, as the main character,
the you know, when you do a biography, for instance, mm-hmm. The main character has to be in every illustration. I mean, it's sort of an unwritten rule. If he's always accompanied by a dog, for instance, that dog has to sort of mimic him and be his companion, whatever. And that's fine, too. But this particular story, which was set in the Revolutionary War, had a dog, you know, a boy and his dog story. And it was, you know, it just didn't sit with me. So I rejected it, and there's been a couple of others that for other reasons I've rejected. Usually if the deadline is too short, I will reject it, but on the other hand, the book that I did on Jackie Mitchell, which was the girl who struck out Babe Ruth, I was coerced, or not coerced, I was sort of Jimmy DeLong to do that book with the deadline of 4 months, and I had never even been to a baseball game. And this is a 48-page book, you know, with an illustration on every page.
The illustrations were beautiful in that one, too. I've seen that
so
one.
And that's won all sorts of awards. So, you know, you just never know.
Do you ever
maybe
feel
you should be pushed to do these things.
That you need, for the sake of your career, to accept. I mean, you obviously don't feel that you have to accept every book that comes your way.
Well, because I also paint for exhibition, I feel as though if there's not a book forthcoming for a while, I can concentrate on my themed exhibitions and work that way. So, so I don't have that drive that a lot of a lot of illustrators are artists, and they do exhibit their work quite apart from their illustrations for books, too. So I think in the 90s, when technology provided the four-color process with a lot more good color and a lot less work, that a lot of artists actually went into illustration.
Oh.
And they do both things. I mean, Gary Kelly, for instance, does both. So so I'm not driven to do, say, 4 books a year.
But have you, though?
I think the most I've ever had on my plate was 2.5. And, you know, you have to break things down again, make sure that you're not crossing over. And
I understand now why your studio was so incredibly beautiful and well organized. Because do you do 2 books simultaneously? Is that what you're saying?
You can do, yes.
That
yes,
really sounds like you'd have to be very organized and efficient.
You might be working on the research in an early stage on one, and then working on the finished artwork for the one that has to meet the deadline shortly. So
you were telling us about your process, and I think I interrupted you with.
So the first part is the research, and next comes actually sketching out the illustrations, and that's usually done after I've received a book layout, or page layout, which has the text broken down into sections. And so I use that. I can rearrange the text up to a point and have my illustrations fit slotted into the text. Because
what would that be like, rearranging the text? Is that just you're moving like one page to a different
point. So you have two pages, and you have a little bit of text at the top and a little bit at the bottom, and that's interfering with a particular composition of illustration that I'm thinking of. So I can move both to the bottom.
Oh, I see. You're
or
not,
both to the
you're
top.
You're not changing the order of, like, page three becomes page
or,
five.
Or maybe put them on one page and use a full page illustration rather than a double page spread. You know, you can do that. So I do that, and then I submit an Illustrator layout to the publisher, and I usually have the picture in color for every page in the book, and then below it I describe, in case there's any ambiguity in the pictures, where and what the main character and everyone else is doing. So then I wait to hear. Usually it takes 2 or 3 weeks for the editorial and art departments to get together and look over this. And I wait to hear that I'm okay to do the final artwork, which is, you know, each illustration I then put on good paper, and then I start, you know, just... that's also when I... use models.
So tell us how you find your models. Is it always your husband?
Well, whenever possible it is, because he's very accommodating and he's there, even if I need him in the middle of the night.
Yeah, tell the readers, but the listeners, about where he appears in the Battle of the Alamo book, because I think I found him on many pages.
He plays Enrique's father, and he also plays the villain, Santa Anna. And he plays some of the many of the defenders, you know, in various postures.
Well, I know I saw a picture of him in your studio, where he's straddling the railing of the deck of your house.
Well, that's for the George Washington book.
Oh, okay.
He was George
but
Washington.
But then in the finished,
as well.
Finished artwork, it's not a railing. It's actually a character sitting on a horse.
That's right.
I thought that was pretty cool.
It was George sitting on a horse. So he's played George Washington. He's played in Frederick Douglass. He's played the slave driver and Abraham Lincoln. In some of the folk tales, he's been an alligator for me, and Anansi and the Box of Stories, he was the chimpanzee, which I introduced into the story. There was no mention of a chimpanzee in the text. And
the way that you used him as a model is you had him grasping something like a bar above his head.
That was based on my layout. So I do the illustrations in a very loose way when I'm doing the layout, knowing that I will have everyone to my house for a photo shoot, and we'll get down to using the models. And I use models because I like that light falls on a form in in a particular direction, and so I use them with that in mind. And they also bring this wonderful, expression, individual expression to the story. I've already thought of what I want the character to do, but somehow they always extend it in a way I haven't thought about, and really add to the piece. And, you know, Stuart, I would have never thought he knew how to knuckle his hands under being a chimpanzee. I hadn't yet gone to a zoo. And also, you know, he was the chimpanzee, but I made sure that I visited the Lincoln Park Zoo and the Blank.
Similitude.
Right.
There.
So, but I also find many of my models in shopping malls. The African American Museum was extremely helpful for Frederick Douglass.
For the Frederick Douglass
book, because it required so many African Americans. And I do have friends that are African American, but not so many. And so I then approached the art director there, and he said, just leave it with me, Jeannie. And the next day he called and said, I think I've got about 30 models from you, because I announced it in church yesterday. So, and sure enough, you know, and they
How
all came over and they
then?
Were wonderful.
Did you use all 30?
Yes, there were some scenes that were just crowd scenes, and he had also provided me with the main model, Frederick Douglass, who was absolutely perfect. For Nancy in the Box of Stories, I relied on the African American Museum again, the curator there. I asked if she knew of anyone, and she put me in touch with this very long, lean basketball player who was perfect again, you know. So, you know.
When the book comes out, do you give the models like a copy of the book or tell them about it? Or put
They have to sign a release, and I pay them. Not fantastically well, but I do that. And then when the book comes out, I sign a book for them.
That's really nice.
So,
Do you get a budget for that from your publisher?
No, this is all out of my payment. So,
and your dedication to making the book the best possible book it can be.
Yeah, I don't have to use models as far as anyone else is concerned. It's my process.
Right. So, in addition to being an artist, you're also actually a writer. You have had experience writing for your communications work that you did early in your career.
Communication arts. I've written screenplays and scripts, and I've done a lot of copywriting for various things. I've written commercials, and mainly for my television and film time, you know, when I was producing and directing and, you know, just sort of chief cook and bottle washer.
Doing it all.
Yeah.
And today, one of the ways that you use your writing, besides, I know that you're also working on books that you would like to illustrate some of your own books. I know you've got that ongoing. But another way that you use your writing and communicating skill is that you write narratives to go with presentations you give in different arenas. So I was wondering if you might share a little bit of your writing with us today.
Oh, well, I'd be happy to. I just have this page in front of me from the Facing the Cradle exhibition that I had at the African American Museum. I think it was in 03 and 04. And that was the first exhibition that the new museum had. And I submitted a proposal, and they asked me to go ahead with it. And basically what it was you followed my career for those 3 years in Africa, when I painted and I kept a journal and I photographed everything, and basically this is the narrative from the talk I gave. So there's a map here at this juncture, and it says, while living in Kenya, for the first time I felt compelled to paint the land, breaking it down into its simplest components. I sketched people and wildlife, but concentrated my canvases on solely depicting the landscape, flat color, simple form, directed by my brush. And then from the journal I wrote, I am sitting surrounded by the soothing aroma of tea coming from the deep green carpet of tea fields that grace these beautiful hills in Kericho. The sounds of children and birds, the sight and smell of flowers and tea, lull me into a peaceful, lazy mood these mornings. The afternoons are different. Like some immense clockwork, the blue sky ticks over to gray, and noisy rumblings call the thunderheads to strike the fields with sheets of rain. A dramatic sight, a powerful sight, but strangely, the clean, earthy smell it brings as it washes the landscape comforts and gives me a feeling of well-being. This is the beauty of Kenya, the contrasts in nature that touch the senses in some profound way. In Kenya, Western influence was minimal. This, again, is from a plaque and not the diary. Toys and books were scarce and expensive. We had no television, video, or telephone. These touchstones of Western culture, which can make us passive and anxious if we are not careful. From the diary, I've been painting canvases of the tea fields exclusively for our walls, a sunset over the tea for the dining room, a tea plucker over the mantel, tea here, there, and everywhere. Here I photograph, then sketch the land, wildlife, and people. It is better to work this way. Nothing sits still for long in Africa. Again, describing something. The Western Highlands, which favors tea growing, has moderate temperature and climate year-round, reflecting its added altitude at 7,000 feet and position on the equator, where seasonal changes are minimal. On the equator, the sun rises at 6:30 a.m. every morning, and it sets at 6:30 p.m. every night. As it sets, it slices through ribbons of cloud in full spectrum color, disappearing in a glorious 2-minute flash. In the tea, the end of the day is marked by drinking sundowners, toasting the twilight before retiring inside for the night. In Kenya, time seems eternal, predictable, and fleeting. Then I describe, like much of the middle class in Kenya, African white and East Indian, we had domestic help. Our household consisted of Ruth, Tegan's ayah or nanny, Alois, our cook and houseboy for 2 years, followed by John, Silfanus, our gardener, and an askari who kept watch outside at night, I wrote. Ruth and Lois have their quarters in our compound at the Tea Research Foundation, but each of them have homes and shambas, that's farms, elsewhere too. These are maintained by other family members. Both Ruth and Alois's children go to a free government school in Kericho. Their government health care is also free, drugs are available, doctors are very well trained, but hospitals are very basic, where unsheeted beds are shared and meals and drink supplied by family members who also provide nursing care. When Tegan was 2 months old, she was made an honorary member of the Kipsigis tribe. She was given the name Chaliknut, which means female child born in the evening. As in other African tribes, the Kipsigis child will carry this name until given an earned name when initiated into adulthood through circumcision between the ages of 15 and 23. Many Kenyan children are baptized and have Christians' names as well. African children are born into age sets. For the Kipsigis, there are 7 age sets in life. Children born in the same year are grouped through life, like being in the same age group at school. Each age set proceeds into the next phase of life together until the set is cast again after the cycle of 7. Kenyan children are very innovative when empty tin cans and cereal boxes they will build carts and cars. Banana leaves make boxes and stuffed animals, and any handy material is used to fashion dolls. Near Meru, north of Nairobi, where sisal is grown and harvested for basket making, sisal strains are braided together into dolls. At an early age, children learn to use pangas or machetes as tools for digging, cutting, and chopping. Rural children work hard herding, farming, helping their parents with chores and business, and going to school. And I'll end it there.
Thank you. That was beautiful. I enjoyed the voice in your writing. I feel like you have your own distinctive voice, and I hope you do succeed eventually in publishing some either excerpts from your journals or, you know, whatever kind of nonfiction or fiction you decide to do.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not getting any younger.
Well, I think you have a real wealth of material because you had the discipline to not only do your art while you were in Kenya, but also write in your journal every day. And I'm wondering, like, where does that self-discipline come from?
I don't know whether it's self-discipline more than any other thing. When you're living in a place as an artist, you look at everything with your eyes open. And I think artists have always had to somehow jot down notes for the colors they see, at least definitely before color photography. You know, they made notes about, for instance, the colors that they saw in a sunset. And
That sounds so difficult to describe color.
Well, it is. I think it's very difficult, and so there's that, and also, you know, it makes you remember or recall better, and I think, and then you can always sketch too the scene and color it.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept that artists have a color memory that might be more vivid than other
people. I think some people are different from others. I mean, we all see color differently, and which I think is interesting. When you have a viewer looking at a painting, they don't feel the same emotion in some cases that the color, you know, is supposed to provide, because color is a very emotional,
personal
thing.
I want to remind listeners that you're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield Radio and beyond. You can stream online at KRUUFM.com, and we are the first and only solar-powered station in the Midwest.
Yay!
Very innovative here. And I am Cheryl Fusco-Johnson. I've been standing in for Monica Hadley, the normal host of the show Writers' Voices, and you've been listening to Jenny Reeves. We have just a few minutes left in our show today, and I had some questions about... One was, you know, how you manage to get so much work done. I'm kind of curious about what a typical work day is for you.
Well, when I have a deadline to meet a book on, generally I get up at 5 in the morning, I head to the gym, I do an hour of spinning, usually, and weightlifting.
Spinning is like bicycling.
Yes, cycling, with an instructor. And then I come home, shower, and go to my drawing table and start sketching.
So what time are you at your table by then, since you've gotten?
Probably by 7:15, and then depending on what stage the work is at and what deadline I have, I can work through until 9 o'clock, you know, at night.
For a minute, I thought you meant an hour and 45
minutes.
Well,
sometimes I do take a break at lunchtime, walk around, and
Do you eat at your desk, or are you working all day?
I don't usually eat during the day, but I wait until my husband comes home and we have another break at supper time, and then I go off, and if I have anything to do, I do it. If not, then I sort of read. If I'm doing another project, read about that. And
this is at 9 o'clock at night when you've finished your work for the day. Then you're kind of reading and starting to think about what you're going to do the next day.
Mm-hmm, right.
Wow, that's a lot of focus.
Well, doesn't everybody do it? I think if you have a 9-to-5 job, you're probably focused in a similar way.
That sounded like a 12-hour day, though, didn't it?
Well, yeah, but doesn't everybody do, actually, a 9-to-5? Nobody does a 9-to-5 anymore.
Impressive. So have you ever made use of any sort of a support system for your art? And if so, what was that?
You mean other artists?
Right. Like, did you ever belong to, like, do artists have critique groups for each other, like writers sometimes do? Or did you join any trade organizations?
You know, I think illustrators and artists are probably far too busy to have groups. But they often stage exhibitions or glum, you know, you're offered an exhibition through friends, and then your work is actually critiqued at the gallery or museum or wherever it happens to be. But by and large, artists and illustrators are really, really busy doing their own personal art. And it's not like the critique groups that come up for authors, where you sit and you critique other people's different stories. And so, yes, we have a support group, but it's more, you know, indirect way of supporting the general artist and illustrator to just carry on through really rough times, you know.
Do you have to spend much of your time marketing? I know, like, authors make a lot of appearances at libraries, and particularly mm-hmm. children's authors go to schools. Do you do much
there's
of that?
There's promotion, and I don't do a lot of it now. I used to do a lot more, but I would rather produce than I would promote, and so I just sort of rely on what has come before. And if anyone, you know, wants me to exhibit, they usually contact me now, as I'm getting to that age where it's getting tough to promote all the time. Although it's a perfect time to promote because of all of the high technology. It's much, much easier than it was when I used to, you know, do that.
And I know you but do some of that because you have a beautiful
I have a website, which is just such a wonderful thing. You know, I mean, before you would have brochures that you'd have to update all the time. And then you'd have to send them off. And now you can send them directly to your website.
And would you like to tell us your website?
It's called www.jeanireeves.com. And it's J-E-N-I, the first name. And it's all one.
And how do you spell Reeves?
R-E-E-V-E-S.com.
And now through the end of August 31st, you can see some of Jeanie's work at the Phelps Youth Pavilion in the Waterloo, what is it called? Cultural Waterloo Center for the Arts.
Right. And the Phelps Youth Pavilion.
Right. And it's a wonderful exhibit. Three other children's book authors are also represented in that exhibit. Do you have any words of advice for other artists
for
coming
emerging
up through the ranks?
You know, you have to have talent, I think, initially to do this, but I think what's more important is perseverance and just the process, just to keep going and improving. And if there is a life class or something you can take from a university, just go and do that, because you'll meet other artists and you're all doing something constructive towards your own career. So just keep going, basically, if you have the talent, and you will if you have the talent, I think.
What are some of the things that you've learned as through this process of being an artist? Do you have any particular life lesson that you're really thrilled that you were an artist and persevered and have kept at it?
I've never really thought about that. I mean, what jumps to my mind is a great brush cleaner, you know.
A great brush cleaner for your
right.
paintbrushes.
I love to watch. You know, I'm a watcher. I love watching nature. I love correlating the past with the present. And I love watching human nature. And so it always surprises me, because there's always something new and old about it as well.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.